All right, Marty. Once more, let's go over the entire plan and layout. I apologize for the crudity of this model, but
yeah,
I just...
Yeah, no, Doc, it's not the scale. It's okay, Doc.
All right. Tomorrow night, Sunday, we'll load the DeLorean onto the tracks here on the spur, right by the old abandoned silver mine. The switch track is where the spur runs off the main line 3 miles out to Clayton. Shonash Ravine. The train leaves the station at 8 Monday morning. We'll stop it here, uncouple the cars from the tender, throw the switch track, and then we'll borrow the locomotive and use it to push the time machine. According to my calculations, we'll reach 88 miles per hour just before we hit the edge of the ravine, at which point we'll be instantaneously transported back to 1985 and coast safely across the completed bridge.
What does this mean? Point of no return.
That's our fail-safe point. Up until there, we still have enough time to stop the locomotive before it plunges into the ravine. But once we pass this windmill, it's the future or bust.
All right, you want to try that again?
Let's do it. I'm going to do another clap.
Okay. Okay. Oh, it's the similarities between what gives you joy and what gives my 16-month-old joy are many. Hey, everybody. Welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Pod 3... You know, at some point you realize maybe you just don't have it anymore. Hello, everyone, and welcome back once again to Podcast Part 3, the Part 3 Podcast, your go-to source for all things about movies that came after two other movies. Unmistakably, I am Sam.
And I am Will.
And we are back. We are back after a little break, took a little time off to, I don't know, do whatever it is we do. It's certainly not writing because our industry doesn't make things anymore, as it turns out. So we're going to talk about something from an era where they made lots of things, the late 80s and early 90s. And we're specifically talking about something maybe that didn't need to get made. Yeah, I said it. I'm going there. We're talking about Back to the Future Part 3.
Ah, yes. The one of... Was this like the first sort of franchise movie that was shot at this, like two movies shot at the same time and split into two released movies?
No, because you've got all the couple of con jobs the Salkins pulled off.
True, but this was...
This is the first time where they cut two different checks to Michael J. Fox and Christopher Lloyd. Yes, this is sort of one of the first of a little trend that happens now and then where you got one big movie that's a hit and then you decide, let's make this a trilogy and make two movies back to back and... The second one is ambitious and deeply flawed, and the third one's a fucking mess. It's happened with Pirates, it's happened with The Matrix, and it's certainly happened here.
Yeah, and it's a trend that I don't like, because it is clear that the filmmakers usually focus on one movie at the expense of another movie. And it usually is the second movie gets like all the filmmakers' attention, and then the third movie sort of it feels like an afterthought in a lot of ways.
Well, Robert Zemeckis was filming this in Northern California and flying down every evening to Burbank to edit part two. Then he'd stay the night in Burbank and get on a plane the next morning and go back to Northern California to film Back to the Future part three. Which admittedly was the easier movie to film because it's only one set and it's only one time period, but that's part of its problem, which we'll get into. So, yeah. I mean, once again, if you're a millennial like us, you don't really need any introduction to Back to the Future. It's right up there. It's one of those load bearing pillars for Gen X and millennials for sure, and it's iconic, it's very quotable, the score is famous, it's also got the benefit of having never been rebooted or revisited from a nostalgia standpoint, so it feels very... The first one still feels so pure to me.
Yeah, well, and it also helps that that script is so fucking tight and is so good. Like, it is just... Like, almost every choice just... works, and it's so confident, and it just I mean, again, what needs to be said, but it just works on a level that like a lot of movies right out the gate just don't, you know.
No, it's It is like everything that needed to work on that movie worked. Like the cast is great,
right?
The effects are great, the action is great, and it is such a tight screenplay. Like, you know, obviously if you think about any time travel movie, it's going to have holes in it, but you don't think about those in the moment with Back to the Future, and it's one of those few genre comedies where it the sci-fi and the comedy both work really well.
Right, and I think the thing that really makes that movie, like, tick, I think when you really drill down to it, is I think it has one of the best emotional hooks I think you could possibly have for a comedy, which is, what if you could meet your parents as peers? Like, I really think that is just so, like, just awesome as a premise, you know?
Yeah, no, it's great. Because it was Spielberg produced it. This is the Amblin movie that they want you to think Ghostbusters was. Now. Like, this is that movie where it's like a comedy, but it's also got like this great heart, and it's like an adventure, and you have that score, that Alan Silvestri score, and. Yeah, like, this is that movie, not Ghostbusters. So if you're only coming into Ghostbusters and you're like, I like Frozen Empire, what's like that? Yeah, it's this. It's Amblin stuff. It's Goonies and Back to the Future. And it was directed, and I think also it's like, and he's, we said, Robert Zemeckis, you know, obviously he still makes movies, but I think he's like kind of a bit of a punchline these days. You know, he did like the motion capture stuff in the 2000s, but Back to the Future came in between Romancing the Stone and fucking Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
So like he was on a roll there.
Yeah, exactly. And after coming off sort of, I mean, Zemeckis and Bob Gale made Used Cars, and they had written 1941 for Spielberg, and Used Cars in 1941 were colossal sort of failures, but then Romancing the Stone was such a big hit that then he could kind of do the movie he wanted to do, which was Back to the Future, and that sort of kicked off his career proper.
And that let them in turn do Who Framed Roger Rabbit,
which exactly.
From a technical standpoint, like, such an ambitious movie.
Right.
And also wildly successful. And also, thank God, has not been sequelized or rebooted.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that Chip and Dale movie was kind of a Roger Rabbit sequel. Isn't that I didn't watch it, so I don't know.
I mean, it is in the sense that it's like, what if cartoons were real? But like every movie where like an animated character hangs out with live action characters doesn't mean it's Roger Rabbit. Like, right. Cool World is not Roger Rabbit.
No.
It's Roger Rabbit for dad.
For the divorced dad living alone.
You rented our son Cool World? No, I rented our son Milo and Otis. I rented Cool World.
Oh, what a night at Blockbuster that would be.
Oh my God. Cool World is one of my favorite oddities of the 90s because it is just a movie where it's like, what? What if Bob Hoskins went for it and hooked up with Jessica Rabbit?
And it caused the universe to end? Like, that's sort of the premise of the movie.
And it's also from that tiny window in time where Gabriel Byrne would be higher on the call sheet than Brad Pitt.
Yes.
But I digress. So after Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it was time to get back to Back to the Future. And so they did, they decided, let's make part two and part three back to back. Zemeckis worked on the story. Bob Gale came back to do the script. And Back to the Future 2 came out in 1989 and part three in 1990. And part two is a movie I will say lots of people our age adore. Yep. Back to the Future part two. And maybe my problem is I didn't see it. I didn't see either of these movies until I was in college. I'd never seen the sequels until I was older. And that's much like when you see Breakfast Club after you graduated high school, maybe it doesn't resonate the same way, which is why I don't like the Breakfast Club. But I am not as big a fan of part two as some people are. I accept that lots of people love it, but I think they only love like the first half and forget that it's like it, it falls apart in the home stretch.
I think that's true, but I think also like a lot of the iconic stuff that came out of this franchise is all in part two. You know, there's the flying car, there's the hoverboards, there's the future stuff, and like all the things that were in the Back to the Future ride are pretty much in from Back to the Future part two. And I think that's true, and all the stuff that was in the cartoon, although that put in a lot of stuff from Back to the Future part three as well, but like a lot of that like iconic stuff is all people remember from part two. And while I agree, Sam, I think the story doesn't really work. It's not as tight. And part of that is its function as being, you know, the first part of a two-part movie. I do think that there is so much fun to be had in that movie that you don't sort of think about how the story doesn't work, you know?
Yeah, I think both the sequels lack the, like, tight pacing of the first one. I just remember watching part two, and there's that final sequence where they're in the tunnel in Biff's car, and I'm like, this is going on forever. We have been in this tunnel for a month. Yeah. And it's like, yeah, I get why people like it, and I think it's just, like, it just doesn't click with me, but it's certainly, like, it's swinging for the fences. It's got some crazy design stuff.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, the future that worships the 80s. It's, you know, it's a classic, like, you know, the distant future of 2015 thing. You know, the cast is all, like, no one's bored in Back to the Future 2. They're all still trying. I would say the problems are all in the script, because it's also, and we'll talk about this for part three, the character assassination of Marty McFly. the like, we have to give this guy a needless arc.
Yeah, well, and it's I mean, I you said this as we were sort of texting about the movies. It's less of an arc and more just sort of a runner. It's not even, it's like this like half-assed arc where it's like, oh, he hates being called chicken and it makes him sort of like do stupid things.
Well, it's, and I've forgotten all about this until I watched part three. I forgot that like there's this underlying angle of in the future, after Back to the Future One takes place,
right,
not long after, Marty is in some sort of horrible car accident that fucks up his life to the point where in the future he's like, he's just like an insurance guy or a stockbroker.
He's not doing what he wants to do.
He's working for Flea and from Red Hot Chili Peppers, but it's so unclear what that is, that how, why that affects him. You don't talk about, like, did it mean he can't play the guitar anymore? It's so, I'm sure if I watch part two again, it would at least try to establish it, but it's turned into, like, it's played in part three on the level of, like, you know, Doc is trying to tell Marty what happens to him in the same way in part one, Marty wants to tell Doc, like, you're going to get killed.
Right.
And it's like, it's played with that same weight, but the whole time I'm like, what accent? What are they talking about?
Right, yeah, yeah.
They hang so much of Marty's character on this thing that happens to him, and they never show it, and they
never
explain it enough.
Like, yeah. Well, and it's all sort of in, like, tossed off bits of dialogue that, like, other characters hear or that Doc knows, and it is so strange to me that the whole first act of Back to the Future Part 2 is predicated on Marty and Jennifer going to the future and fixing this problem that happens with their kids, when it's sort of like, wasn't Doc's whole thing not to change the future in the first movie? And like, it's just, it's so odd that then it's like this accident has to be kept a secret for, because otherwise it could ruin the space-time continuum or something. Like, it's so weird.
Yeah, maybe they felt like they kind of put themselves in a corner with the cliffhanger ending of the first movie.
Right.
But it is like, he's really like sending it. I forget what it is exactly, but it feels like Doc is like, I got to bring you two from the past to 2015 to like get Marty Jr. to do his homework or something like really... Not do
a crime is sort of what it really came down to.
Not a life and death situation at all. And I think that's part of the problem with these movies is that, you know, they, it does feel like there's never been a proper antagonist. Right. Perhaps like Biff is your antagonist in this, or Buford Tannen. But it is, it's like when the first movie works, your antagonist is time.
Right.
Like that's the enemy. It's like you're in a race against time to like save your own future and make sure you're actually born.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in part two, you know, to a much lesser extent, to a greater extent in part three that feels like it's on that level. It's just sort of rehashing the, we've got to get back to the future, and we broke the fucking car in a new way.
Well, I mean, you know, there is the whole thing with the sports almanac and going back in time and trying to, like, you know, make money, and you end up inadvertently creating, like, dystopian 85, which is all sort of fun. It's like there's too many ideas in Back to the Future Part 2, and then the narrative, it's the same, my same problem with the Matrix sequels too. It's like there's too many ideas in Reloaded, and then Revolutions just can't pick up any of the stuff that was dropped by the wayside. You know what I mean? It's the same thing and here.
And it, weirdly, that's what happens with the Star Wars sequel trilogy right. as well.
Exactly.
It's like, and those movies, at least you have the excuse of they had no plan.
Yeah, they weren't made at the same time.
These ones were mapped out, you know? What's your excuse? Part three is, as it, you know, part two takes place in 1985, 2015, 1985 again, back to 1955. And so it's all over the place. Like, it goes back and forth. It's got lots and lots of time travel in it to the future and the past. This one, on the flip side, is just the Old West. It's 1885 Hill Valley, and it's populated entirely by old Western actors and ZZ Top. So it's
and various bits and pieces of cast from the first two movies.
Yes, Michael J. Fox penciled into the Crispin Glover. This is the problem with the sequels. You go back and watch Back to the Future 1, you forget how awesome Crispin Glover is in that movie, how good he is in that role, and how important he is to the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, he celebrated Crazy Person, Crispin Glover, and he didn't come back for the sequels. And I think that does really, you lose something not having that character, because they're still trying to have versions of the McFlys throughout time. So you have Leah Thompson, but now suddenly her husband is her son, you know?
Yeah, it's very weird, and the weirdest part about this movie is that it is like, it was like Zemeckis thought, I want to make a Western. Like every sort of boomer filmmaker, like of his generation, is like, I'm gonna make my Western.
Like and every, like, yeah, like you're absolutely every single one of them. Every other director like Zemeckis was like, after Silverado came out, they must have been like, oh, I wanted to make Silverado. Where's my cast of thousands?
Exactly. And so it was sort of like, well, I guess I'm never going to get my shot to do a Western. I may as well fold Back to the Future.
Which is such a, I mean, I think you're onto something, but I'm also like, you can make a Western, man. Well, they're super easy.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, because all this movie is just West, like, playing with Western tropes with the Back to the Future characters.
Yeah, and not even, honestly, almost all the action in it is just Western action. There's not enough.
Yeah, exactly.
You have so much weirdness in part two and, like, anachronistic action in part one, like the skateboard and stuff. You don't have any of that. Most of it is literally, like, it's you know, getting lassoed or a runaway buggy or literally the climax of A Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah, exactly. And so it just sort of plays like a sort of a parody of a Western, and like a lot, like the, like some of the jokes that worked in Back to the Future Part 1, like when Marty goes in and orders a Pepsi and he's like, I want a Pepsi free. And the soda, you know, joint owner is like, you want a Pepsi, you're going to pay for it, pal, which is fine. Like, that's a great joke. But like when you transpose it to 1885, it just like when he starts doing the moonwalk and it's like, all right, dance, you know, it becomes like, oh my God, this is just a cartoon.
Yeah. And it's cartoonifying Marty, who yeah. is meant to be kind of the straight man of this world. And I think the thing that this movie, it's trying to give Doc more of an emotional arc, which I think is great. Yeah. And obviously Christopher Lloyd's up to the challenge, and but it's also trying to service this Marty arc of he doesn't like being called a coward, so he tries to prove himself.
Right.
But that's what got him in trouble in the future, and then it just becomes the kind of dragged out thing of like, is he gonna stand up to this guy who's gonna kill him, or is he afraid he's gonna be called a coward? And it's just like, okay, who gives a fuck? I want to see the DeLorean.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of it too, and it's like it you almost want Doc to have sort of the arc across the two movies. You almost want to flip Doc's role from part one into part two, where Doc is all about not changing the future, and then you want to flip it so that Marty is the one about not changing the future.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I think there's something to that, because in part two, it's Marty's like, we could get I got this almanac and we could change the future. And Doc is like, do not do that. And Marty's selfishness does end up completely fucking up the future and they have to fix it. Now in the third one, he's learned, but Doc is in love and tempted to not, kind of break from his own philosophy about this stuff. And,
right.
you know, it's so half-hearted, like, yeah. that, you know, the conflict and it just, like, yeah, all the characters, like, I don't know, there's just such a sluggish pace to the movie, and the movie feels so, even more, not even just because it's, like, a Western and it's a smaller scale, it just feels so small, and it does yeah. feel like, like you said, Will, like, they put all their chips in part two, the way they did with yep. Reloaded, or, I don't know, Dead Man's Chest, that's the second
yeah.
one, right?
Yeah.
And maybe this was deliberate. It's like, okay, we'll make the third one location and it'll be super easy,
right?
You know, we can just get all the guys out from the Spawn Ranch or wherever,
you know? they can do their thing, and it just feels like Zemeckis was really excited about making a Western in pre-production, and then once he started making two movies at once, got really tired and stopped caring.
It's got all the stuff, the emotional, like, pokes to make you feel good and make it feel like a rewarding ending to the series. Much like John Williams, I think the Back to the Future score does a lot of heavy lifting a lot yeah. of the time. And I remember the soundtrack for this one. This is the one I remember the soundtrack getting heavily marketed.
Right.
They were so excited that they got ZZ Top to be in their movie.
Oh my God, that is the worst. Their cameo is so bad.
It's like, They did the spinning guitar.
Like, it is so stupid.
It just pulls you right out, because you're just like, even, I don't know how many people know what ZZ Top looks like these days, but it's like, is that ZZ Top?
Yeah, and then they do the spinning guitars.
Beard, no beard, beard. Yeah, that's ZZ Top. Beard, guy named Beard, no beard.
And it's same with, like, the moonwalking joke. It's just like, what are we doing here now? Like, this is yeah. not, like, all the other, like, time travel or, like, you know, culture time jokes in the other two movies at least felt rooted in some sort of character, you know?
They're not, these two feel like they're making jokes about part two and part three are definitely, like, making more 80s references,
right.
or more
yeah.
like, you know, like, oh, the 80s, like, you know, it's so silly, like, in a way that a movie that was made now about the 80s might make references, like the way
yes.
The Wedding Singer makes references.
Yeah.
The first one, it's really the joke, those 80s reference, the Pepsi Free joke, which,
yeah.
like, it's funny and it works, even though I don't know. I've never seen a Pepsi Free. I've never had a Pepsi Free. And honestly, I'm surprised the Pepsi hasn't brought back Pepsi Free just for the sake of tying it into Back to the Future. The way they bring back the like self-tying Reeboks now and then.
Right, right, yeah.
Or remember the when they brought out an actual hover, they made an actual hoverboard and people were like mad that because it didn't work like a hoverboard.
Yeah.
It's like, what did you expect, people?
Oh, boy. I mean, yeah, and it just, and the other thing that this part three has is this weird, mournful tone that clashes against sort of the more, like, you know, cartoony parody, like, Western stuff that they're doing.
Doc is so sad in this movie.
For no real reason.
Well, he's like, I mean, like, I guess he's decided at this point his life's work is like, needs to be destroyed, and he wishes he'd never built it, and he's so mopey, and it bums me out. Like,
yeah.
You know, I think that's why, like, if he was, you know, because he was in love, or because he's like, you know, finally, like, you know, just something to give him a little more spark. Because then, like that, then you lean more on Marty for comedy, and right. I think Marty is best when he's reactive on a certain level.
No, I agree. And then the other thing that sort of is Clara is sort of a thankless character, you know, Doc's love interest. And you almost want her to be part of the adventure more, to like let her into the time travel thing early on instead of her being like, what the fuck, you're crazy, being like, okay, you're a time traveler, let's do it. You know, like,
you need more of Time After Time, Mary Steenburgen.
Exactly.
Like, she gets one look at H.G. Wells and she's like, give me that.
But exactly. I mean, I think like play. I mean, this is obviously like a 2024 note looking back at a 1990 movie. But like, it is sort of like, I don't know. Bring her along for the ride. She's on the poster and in the post.
True.
Like, put her in the fucking DeLorean. Like, why not? I don't know. Like,
God, those posters are so good though.
They rule.
All three of them.
They rule. Those,
that is
so
like
great.
That's apex level Drew Struzan there. like that's it. They're so iconic.
So Sam, I'm going to backtrack a little bit, though. So you said you didn't watch the sequels until college. When did you first see Back to the Future, the first one?
Oh, I saw it. I don't know. It's always been there.
Yeah.
I'm sure my parents rented it or it was on TV or something. I've always had Back to the Future. That one's always been baked in. And 2 and 3, I knew they existed, but for whatever reason,
just
I didn't
never
seek
got
them
to.
Out. I can't tell you why. It's not
no.
like I wasn't... like. I think Back to the Future, it was always there and I always really liked it, but it wasn't like a constant rewatch for me. I didn't own it. I didn't have like a VHS of it. So it wasn't like my movie in the way it is. Like at Hampshire, our little clique, everyone had one movie that was like their movie. Like RoboCop is Will's movie. Back to the Future was our buddy Flanagan's movie. Like, and Back to the Future 2 especially. Like that's... like if your movies, your formative movies, are a map of the solar system and they orbit around you, it's a middle planet. It's like Neptune, you know. It's not, you know, if Star Wars is Mercury, it's a little farther out there for me. But you know, it's a great movie. It's objectively a great movie, and I appreciate the sequels. I'd say even part three, you can watch all three and it feels like a kind of complete journey.
Yeah.
But it's just, this is the weak link. It's the weak link in the same sense that, like, no, I'm not going to say it's like Return of the Jedi, because Return of the Jedi is still way better than this. Like, Return of the Jedi is still like swinging for the fences. I think the problem with this one is it comes off of the, even if you're not a big fan of part two, it feels like a grander, bigger movie than part one.
Yeah.
And then this feels like it's the smallest of the three. So you're just kind of like, that's it. It's just a Western, you know? And if this was like Bill and Ted, where they go like, or a series where everyone like has gone to a different time period, then maybe you can get away with that. But it's already established as a franchise that's less about like what time period you go to and more about, you know, the characters and the wacky shenanigans that are involved with making a time traveling DeLorean work.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you on that. I mean, This was actually the first Back to the Future movie I saw, was Part 3. I saw it on a plane. And then I watched them all as a kid, and I watched the cartoon show pretty religiously.
I've never seen the cartoon.
I haven't seen it since I was probably like 6 or 7, so I can't, you know... yeah, 7. I can't speak to its quality. And I remember when I went on the ride at Universal Studios... when I was like 12, just having a fucking blast.
It's a classic ride. It's one of the ones that right up there with Journey into Imagination, where I think the replacement just pisses people off.
Yeah.
I don't think people like the Simpsons ride nearly as much as Back to the Future.
No, the Back to the Future ride was so much fun. For those who don't know, it was basically Star Tours, but you're in a DeLorean.
Yeah, and it was a different setup too, because it was like, if you the way it was set up, it was actually like an amphitheater with like 9 DeLoreans.
So
you're looking at a much bigger screen. It's like Star Wars and Soarin' kind of combined into one thing. And you know, you had Christopher Lloyd. Oh, Christopher Lee as a rival time-traveling evil scientist.
Oh, he would have been great.
Oh, it was so good. Yeah, that's, I think I needed more to expand the time travel lore.
Like, yeah.
Is this the only time machine out there?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, or if you're going to go with him being, you know, having this Oppenheimer, like, I have created the worst thing in the world, have other time travelers start showing up and wanting to meet him or something.
Yeah.
You know, even if you know
the reboot will be Doc Brown's grandkid from the future shows up in a time machine and needs to take, I don't know, Marty's daughter from, you know, it's like the future changed. 2015 isn't like we remember it, you know?
Luckily, I think Zemeckis and Gale have it in their contracts that there cannot be a Back to the Future 4. So it won't happen until they're dead.
He's learned his lesson with digital de-aging, maybe. God, I found it online, and I don't know if it's... I don't know how real it is, but the test footage from his mocap yellow submarine.
Ooh, yikes.
Thank you. It was basically like a movie, an entire movie of like Beatles Rock Band. Right. You know?
God.
It's like, I don't know, man. I think the first one said all it needed to say.
Yeah, I remember when that was announced and being like, oh boy, this we dodged a bullet, I think, with that.
Maybe he saw Across the Universe and was like, you know what?
Never mind.
Maybe the Beatles are just fine on their own. They don't need our help.
Oh, man.
And then after this, he does everything Zemeckis does after Back to the Future, unfortunately, is some form of, like, pushing the technical envelope.
Right.
He enters his Cameron era. For better or worse, because Death Becomes Her, I really like. I think
that's
fun. A lot of fun.
It's
got some cool effects. Then it's Forrest Gump, and I don't know what else there is to say about Forrest Gump at this point. You either love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
It's kind of just there.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it's like one of those movies that... I really liked in high school.
This is like an important movie. Exactly. This is like one of these movies my parents like to see.
Yeah.
It's so good. Like, he meets Kennedy.
And it has such an emotional like punch to that movie, but it's not very good.
It's so saccharine, and it's so weird too.
Yeah, it's a very odd movie.
I don't know in the modern lens how great Jenny is as a character. Speaking of a thankless role.
Castaway, I think, has something to say for it.
He did Castaway, and then in the middle of Castaway, while Tom Hanks was losing weight, he did What Lies Beneath.
That's right, which is a fun movie.
It's fun. He's like, I want to make a De Palma movie.
Yeah.
And then we're in Mocap City, and that kind of just like kills a decade of Zemeckis, because none of those movies, they all are just the technical advances of them hold the movie back.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have fun with Beowulf, but yes, I completely agree. It's not
Beowulf is not fun for the reasons they intended it to be fun. Beowulf is hilarious.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Just... I just love that the only reason that movie is mocap is because Ray Winstone
does not look like that guy.
And I'm just like, I don't know, man. Zack Snyder just got Gerard Butler and made sure he was all shredded and shit. Like,
and that came out the same year as Beowulf.
And it looks terrible in a completely different way. That works for the movie.
Zemeckis is sort of, and then, you know, he's had like stuff he's made recently, but I don't know. It all like never, it all feels like sort of movies that don't exist, you know? Like,
well, it's like, it's there. He had that period where he did, well, he did Flight and he did the Walk or whatever. Right, what's his version called?
I think it's The Walk.
Yeah. Yeah. Man on Wires. The
documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, he did, until I looked at his list, I had no idea he'd done Allied with Brad Pitt and Marianne Cotillard.
Right. That's right. The like sexy movie, spy movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Like that was definitely like, ooh, this could be an Oscar buzz movie. And then it just kind of came and went. And then it's Welcome to Marwen and the Witches and Pinocchio.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ouch. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's Hollywood law now that if you're not hired to do a Star Wars or a Marvel, you're hired to do the live action adaptation.
Yeah.
So you get Robert Zemeckis's Pinocchio and Guy Ritchie's Aladdin and
Tim Burton's Dumbo and it is so sad.
It's like
sad.
A whole podcast of just iconic directors from the 80s and then going, "Wahapa." It's not too late.
No. Oh boy.
That's why I respect Joe Dante. Joe Dante is just like, I'm just going to do like Trailers from Hell.
I mean, he's like, and he makes a movie every once in a while, and it seems like his heart's still in it when he can get like the financing going to make a movie.
But he feels like he didn't sell out to the man.
No.
You know?
No. And Dante has some like great, like unsung movies like Matinee, you know.
Matinee's
like,
great.
You know,
I mean, I think people are, Gremlins 2 still doesn't get the love it deserves.
No, I agree.
And Small Soldiers. I really like Small Soldiers.
Small Soldiers is pretty good too.
Underrated movie. And Phil Hartman's last movie.
Oh yeah.
I saw it at the drive-in movie theater in Lunenburg, Massachusetts. No. Double feature with Men in Black.
Oh, not a bad double feature.
Not a bad double feature. I saw Mask of Zorro there too. It's a great drive-in. I think it's still there, but I saw that, and then I saw a double bill of The Descent and Snakes on a Plane.
Ooh.
And those are both perfect drive-in movies.
Yeah, they are.
In different ways. One is fantastic, and one is like eating a bunch of Kraft singles.
So, I mean, I know I've been to the, I went to the drive-through a couple times. I can't remember. I know that there were two movies playing, but I can't remember what the, I remember seeing Captain Ron, the Kurt Russell comedy, but I can't remember what the second movie was.
I was like, fuck, you're old.
I saw,
how are you like you're like 2 years older than me, but somehow also like 20 years older than me.
I saw What About Bob at the drive-in too. but Sam, you'll
Captain
love this.
Ron.
You'll love this, though. You will love this. The double feature that was actually like advertised as a double feature that I saw was the 1995 Judge Dredd.
Nice.
And Congo.
Oh. Well, I know where I'm taking my DeLorean. Fuck yes.
To some random theater in Salt Lake City in 1995.
You know the best thing is if Judge Dredd is first, you're about halfway into Judge Dredd and you're like, God, I forgot this really does suck. And then, but then you're like, oh no, I'm getting Congo. I'm getting Congo. I'm getting Joey Pants. I'm getting Delroy Lindo. I'm getting British Ernie Hudson. Now, Congo is... It may be closer in my planetary movie orbit than Back to the Future.
I know,
it
that's
may,
why I...
It may be close, it may be Mars. It's like, I unironically love that movie. It's so cheesy. It's like, there need to be more movies like that being made.
Yes, I agree. Well, have you seen, you haven't seen Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire yet, have you?
I have not. I have not been to the movies probably since Congo came out because of my kid.
Well, Well, I will say it's got a, in some instances, it has a very Congo-esque vibe, so.
This is the thing I tell people all the time. You're probably never going to get to make King Kong. You're probably never going to get to make Gorillas in the Mist, but you might get to make Congo. So you owe it to yourself to watch Congo so you can learn how to make the best Congo you can.
Yes. Hell yeah.
And I think that's the problem with Back to the Future Part 2 is it's not the best Back to the Future Part, or Back to the Future Part 3, it's not the best Part 3 it can be.
Yeah.
We know they're capable of more, and I think it's just the classic third movie, everyone's tired, everyone's bored thing manifests in just the tone and the scope of the movie.
Yeah.
It's like, we don't want to build a million sets. We're going to go to one Western set, and we're going to make it a town they haven't finished building, so we don't have to finish building the set.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I mean, I like sort of all the little details of, like, the clock tower and stuff, but, like, which just feels like fan service to me now. When I was a kid, I may have appreciated all of that a little bit more, but I don't know
if it's fan service. They don't hang such a huge lantern on it, and
True.
It's not like a movie that came out like 20 years later.
True.
Or like in Clash of the Titans remake where they keep making jokes about the mechanical owl.
Right.
You know,
right.
There are these threads that run through all three movies that they do bring around full circle. I think there's just maybe not enough of them to make it feel like one cohesive vision, but there's also just enough that you're reminded of the first movie, and so this one doesn't stand on its own enough.
Yeah.
So you're kind of caught in this weird gray area.
Yeah, and I just think that this one just can't, and the second one too, they just can't pull that emotional hook. I mean, you can't do it again, because, you know, why would you try? But that I'm meeting my parents as peers is just, like, so, like, potent and rich as, like, an idea.
They hang the stakes and the drama and the urgency in all three movies on, we gotta get to X spot at a certain time, or we won't be able to make the time machine work.
Right.
And I think you have to change that up a little bit. They vary the nature of the stakes, but you're still playing, it's still the same dramatic beats as the first movie. Like, it's take care of Biff, then get to the time machine sequence.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
I'm going to say this about all three movies. Tom Wilson, he's got his acting boots on in all three of those movies.
Oh, yeah, he shows up. Yeah.
And he's not playing Biff the same way every time.
Yeah.
Like, Biff is different from Griff, is different from, like, old Biff, is different from, like, he's like, I'm going to play it as a Western villain. Like,
yeah.
He's unrecognized. You don't recognize him. He doesn't look like Tom Wilson in this movie.
Yeah, and you almost want more of him because of that. Like, I think
there was some stuff that got cut.
Okay, it felt like it.
Because Principal Strickland's Western counterpart,
right,
you know, at the end when they get arrested, it's just the deputy.
Right.
There was a sequence where he gets murdered. So there was maybe more with either the gang or with Buford. Because they're good. Like, he's funny. He's great.
Yeah.
He has that Back to the Future energy. And it's like, the Tannins have always been there. And Marty has to change the future to finally make them, you know, betas.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's I don't know. This is a weird movie, because I remember it was one I always watched the least, even though it was the one I saw the first. And
yeah, and the stuff with Marty's family, his ancestors, doesn't work.
Because
he's like, he, they're trying to do a moment with the baby that's kind of like when he's like, so you're Uncle Joey, huh?
Yeah.
But he's like, so you're my great grandfather William, who we've never talked about before, you know?
Right. Or if you're going to play into, like, this idea of Marty being, like, interested, or at least, like, having some thought about his legacy, you want to maybe thread that through these two movies to make this connect to something. Being like, well, I've never, if you're going to even play the same emotional beat, it's sort of like, well, you know, I didn't get to meet my grandparents or whatever. And you get
Or is it, have McFly's been branded slackers throughout
history? Yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, you remind me of your, also Marty and George aren't slackers.
No.
They're like, Marty's he's maybe a loser, a little bit, but he's not a slacker. And I don't know.
Maybe the principal thinks is like a slacker in that they're not actually getting their schoolwork done.
Yeah, that's fair. You know? That's all right. Yeah. No, it's all right. I'm not going to argue with Principal Strickland after all these years.
But I also, you know, it's one of those things that I liked the Back to the Future movies, but I never quite understood the reverence they had for people from our generation. Like, again, I get, like, first movie is unassailably great, but I never quite understood, like, why so many of, like, our brethren, same with Ghostbusters, why our brethren, you know, why our people of our generation love those movies so much, you know?
I think there is,
And I say this as loving Ghostbusters and Back to the Future, but, yeah. Oh, you know,
no,
but...
No,
yeah.
God forbid you besmirch the good name of Ghostbusters. No, I think part of it is... Yeah, I think it's just like Disney movies or Star Wars or Star Trek for other people. You just have to see it at the right time,
yeah.
And it flips a switch in your brain, and it becomes a part of you. And, yeah. You know, that you can still love a movie and not have that happen.
Right.
But... when it does happen, it's like that movie's always been with you, you know, and it could be a movie, it could be music, it could be a TV show. There's this documentary that just came out called Lynch/Oz,
mm-hmm.
and it talks about the influence of Wizard of Oz on David Lynch. But really the takeaway is Wizard of Oz is like the most influential movie ever made.
Cause right.
It's so old, it's so iconic, and it's held up so well that any filmmaker that saw it at a certain point in their life is going to be informed by it. And for other people, that's Back to the Future Star Wars or Planet of the Apes or Ghostbusters, you know, and I love Back to the Future and I love that score and I love the design of that movie and I love the acting in that movie, but it's just not, it's not a desert island movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sort of on that same level too. I mean, I think when I was 12, it might've been, but I don't feel that it never carried with me the same way. I don't know.
No, I don't think it was ever like that for me. I think it was just a good movie, but I had a huge VHS collection and it wasn't in it. And there were movies that I like less that were. Like, I definitely owned 89 Batman, and I don't think that's as good as Back to the Future.
Well, and, you know, I didn't own those movies until they popped out on DVD in, like, 2002 I remember that. Or 2003.
I have that 3-pack. It's still the only version I've got. Yeah, that says something. It's like, is it a movie that you've double-dipped on or triple-dipped on? It's No Evil Dead 2.
No.
How many copies do you and I have of Evil Dead 2, you know?
Yeah.
How many times have I fucking shelled out a needlessly large amount of money for the Star Wars trilogy?
Right, or Army of Darkness and you know, all those, Or the Matrix movies for me. I've double-dipped on those, so...
I almost bought them the other day, and then I remembered I have them already. It was on sale, and then I was like, all my movies are in like boxes right now because they were in the second bedroom. So it's like, for this one, I was like, oh, I don't want to get it out of a box. I'm just gonna rent it. I'll pay the $3. You know, it's like,
yeah,
but it's in there. It's for sure in there.
Yeah, I mean, same. I mean, it's one of those things where. Nowadays, as much as I love physical media and, you know, want physical media to be around so media doesn't go away, I do buy a lot of stuff digitally now.
I go back and forth. It depends on the movie. If I'm not going to own it on Blu-ray, I'm probably not going to buy a digital copy,
right?
Unless I have to, like Ghostbusters Afterlife. But that gave me COVID, so
right.
I'm probably not going back to revisit. Speaking of revisiting movies, speaking of revisiting franchises we've seen before, coming up next, there's a brand new Planet of the Apes coming out, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which is a stupid title, as I've said, City of the County of the Apes, but it looks awesome, we have done the original Apes threequel, Escape from the Planet of the Apes, but now it's time for some top-notch Planet of the Apes bleakness, because we are doing War of the Planet of the Apes.
Hell yeah.
One of the best depressing movies I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll get into it next week, but Katie has been working on doing localization stuff for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, and so we rewatched all three a month or two ago, and I think those are quietly some of the best science fiction movies of the 2010s.
And I would say it's also a series that gets better as it goes.
Yeah, absolutely.
It gets more confident as it goes in the technology, in the characterization of Caesar, to the point where you don't have to rely on clumsily written human characters.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got the best human characters of the trilogy, for sure.
Oh, 100%.
Because it's got Woody. You know?
Woody Harrelson, yeah.
And he's a dick. No, I've only seen it once, because it came out and I was, I think, just like swamped with work and probably switching depression meds at the time, so I was just not in the mood for it. But I remember thinking, oh, this is fantastic. Like, everyone's so good in it. All the mocap performances are fantastic. It's the best. It's, as we've said before, little Andy Serkis goes a long way if you need a gorilla in your movie, and he's so good in those movies.
He really is, and they look. I mean, Matt Reeves just is an incredible director.
And absolutely.
The Dawn and War are just really well directed movies. So this is
beautifully
exciting.
Shot too.
Yeah, they just
He was such a smart choice for the Batman.
Yeah.
It's not that the Batman's not a perfect movie, but it is a fucking gorgeous movie, and it doesn't look like any other Batman movie that's come out.
No, I agree. So that'll be fun to dive into. And
yes, it's the Apes. They've only ever had one bad movie in the whole franchise. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, and it's especially crazy because that first movie, Planet of the Apes, is like one of the most iconic movies ever made. And usually sequels based on iconic movies aren't good.
I think it's because, and I think the benefit of it is, none of the sequels, by virtue of how the first one ends and how the second one ends, have been allowed to be a rehash of the first movie.
Yeah.
Like, you've never been, except for the remake, the Tim Burton version, it's never been just guy lands on planet and discovers a city of apes. Like, Beneath has that, and then some of the weirdest shit you've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
You know?
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that everyone was wise to not be like, we're gonna try for that awesome twist again. We're gonna try and do something different each time, with the exception of the remake, where they were like, well, we've got to have a twist, and that's kind of.
And they're also trying to do things different, but all the things they're doing different don't like feel right, and the all the humans at least are miscast, and it still is like. If nothing else, you know, it was a step up in term on a technical level, because you go from, you know, very campy ape designs to really good Rick Baker practicals.
Yeah.
And that launches you then into the CG apes. I think that's the other thing, is that the thing that it's like the effect of the originals, you know, the ape effects are so they work, because you're not like being told this is like a guy in a, it's not like a guy in a gorilla suit playing King Kong. These just humanoid
actors,
they're all very erudite and stuff. And so that's one way to play it. But if you want to play it as these are actual chimps that are becoming intelligent, it completely changes the tone and the feel and the look of the movie and the physicality of your characters in a way that makes these new ones. I remember when Rise of the Planet of the Apes came out, you and I both thought it was going to be the stupidest thing ever.
I know.
And then we were so pleasantly surprised.
Yeah. We walked out. We were like, oh yeah, this ruled.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm excited, because I always like talking apes. It's such a fun franchise.
Yeah.
And I'm genuinely curious about the new one. I'm curious to
I am too.
What, like, I don't know. I haven't really watched any trailers or something. I'm going in very cold.
Yeah, I've only seen sort of the trailers that have been released, and they've been very cryptic, so I don't quite know, like, what's going on or anything, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Back to the Future Part 3. It's fine. It's, as the kids say, it's mid.
Yeah, I mean, and if you're going to watch them, it's not a waste of time to watch all three. The first one is a classic for a reason, but the other two I think have problems but are worth watching.
Yeah. If you haven't seen them, go watch them, especially the first two, because it's going to be one of those times where if you've got all these references that you've heard in your head from Family Guy or Saturday Night Live or anywhere else are going to get filled in, because it's one of those like tentpole reference movies.
Yeah, exactly.
But exactly. Yeah, you know, we can't win them all. You know, third movie's the hardest one to nail for a reason. It has a lot on its shoulders, and this one just, it's a slacker.
Yeah. Yep. Can't say more than that.
It's true. Next week, War of the Planet of the Apes, starring Andy Serkis and Woody Harrelson and Judy Greer, of all people.
Oh, yeah.
It's so strange who they cast as apes. Yeah. Because it's like, I'm always for Judy Greer in my movies, but it's like, Judy Greer?
Judy Greer? Yeah. As an ape? Okay. All
right. Yeah, and because it's Judy Greer, she's not allowed to do that much in the movie.
Right, of course, because that's also her thing.
It's ape law. All right, everyone. Until next time.
This is heavy.
That's from the movie.
From the movie. Yeah.
DiCaprio meme. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.